Advocacy for Inclusion's Staying Connected podcast series. Last year, we presented a podcast series on supported decision-making. That was about building the important skills we need to support other people when they're making decisions. 2019 feels like a million years ago now. Since then, we've had bushfires everywhere, and then the relief of rain. Now, we together face the challenge of COVID-19 or the coronavirus. In our Staying Connected podcast, we will find our way through these challenging times together. One of the great COVID-19 challenges that many households have faced, particularly in the times when we've been staying at home, has come on the educational front. There have been many repercussions, some anticipated and others not, when physical schools have closed down and education has gone remote through online teaching and work-from-home educational packages. The challenges have proven all the greater in the homes of children and young people with disability. CYDA, Children and Young People with Disability Australia, in collaboration with the University of New South Wales and the Melbourne Graduate School of Education, has come out with a report outlining the experiences of students with disability during COVID-19. The report is called Not Even Remotely Fair, and I'm pleased to welcome CYDA's CEO, Mary Sayers, back to our podcast. Welcome back, Mary. It's great to have you back on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Rob. Glad to be here.
One of the striking things with CYDA's reports is you always give your reports a really striking titles, which I love personally. I think they're great. So this report on the impact on young people with disability in the educational sphere with COVID-19 has the title Not Even Remotely Fair. So it's bristling with this fierce and fearless advocacy energy. Who is it that really needs to read and get their head around this report? Who's the intended audience for the report?
Look, first and foremost, the intended audience is really our members, which are children and young people with disability and their families. And one of the reasons for our very existence is so that we can amplify their voices. And one of the things we want them to know is when they experienced these difficulties, they were not alone. There were many families who were experiencing difficulty, many young students with disability and young people who were completely left behind at this time. So that was kind of the first and foremost. We really wanted to get a pulse because we were getting lots of phone calls in, people telling us schools aren't contacting us, we're not getting accessible resources. So that, I guess, is first and foremost. The next audience really is government and trying to provide a proactive way of feeding back into the COVID response. And one of the things we really want to make sure is that children and young people with disability are planned for in the COVID response. And we know that it's been really tough for everyone, but unfortunately, people with disability generally have struggled to have their voices heard. But we really want to make sure that our members, children and young people with disability, got heard. And then the third audience really is the Disability Royal Commission. So we know that the Disability Royal Commission is investigating into the COVID experiences, and I think we want this to be able to be used so that in future when we have pandemics or disasters, that the needs of students with disability are really well planned for so that they don't experience these types of harms that we found in the report.
The report, it's like more than isolated the previous report. First, it began with a survey, so you had a nationwide survey to gather that vital evidence, because we want evidence that's informing policy, that's informing government thinking. So in terms of the people who engaged with the survey about education, what can you tell us about the people who gave you feedback? Who were they? Where were they? Yeah. What ages are we talking about?
Yeah, look, we had members and people from all around Australia who completed this. So we had over 700 responses in total, which was very similar to our first survey that we conducted in the first 5 weeks of the pandemic. But this one was particularly targeted about the educational experiences. We had, interestingly, from that, around 1,145 free text responses as well. So we had a really rich sort of source of data that could give us lots of the stories behind the stats, if you like. And most of the survey respondents were from families of children and young people with disability, although we did have young people with disability who already who also completed the survey. And we covered the experiences from early childhood right through to post-school education. But the majority of the experiences reported were for primary and secondary age school students. And we had respondents from metropolitan, rural areas. We had people from non-English speaking backgrounds who completed the survey, but perhaps a lesser extent. But there was good Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander representation as well. And most of the respondents did attend government schools, but all education settings were represented. And three quarters of the students were NDIS participants. So that would tell us that the respondents to the survey were more likely to be those that have permanent and lifelong disability as well. And more than half were in receipt of additional funding because of their disability. So we feel like we had a really good sample. However, we would have, and in future we'll be looking at ways that we can ensure we get young people's voice more into our survey work as well. So that's something we really want to focus on in the future.
Have you had any thoughts about how you might be able to capture those voices from the young people directly?
Look, one of the things is making sure, I guess, that the survey is in an accessible format. So that's front and central. We didn't have the survey available in easy read or easy English, or plain English, but also how we could potentially do more qualitative interviews as well. And that's something that we're exploring with the researchers who helped us analyse the data about how we could actually learn more about the post school period, you know, that period kind of years 11 and 12 and then on to the early years of leaving school and what the impact of COVID has been. So that's probably our next priority in our research, to really have a specific focus on capturing young people with disabilities' voice. Yeah.
Mary, one of the things that particularly struck me, and it might in a sense be a little bit incidental, looking at the run-through of the people who responded, 63% of respondents were related to a male student, and then 34% female, 1% other, and then a number, no disclosure. Have you had any reflection about why we had a particular weight to people related to male students coming forward and engaging in the survey?
Look, part of it is, you know, we didn't set out for it to be a representative survey. It was really a survey that was actually trying to capture people's experiences. But what I think it tells us is that, you know, males often have quite a lot of difficulty in education settings because their behaviours might be seen to be more problematic than girls' behaviours. Whereas, you know, this is anecdotal, but, you know, families have shared with us the experiences around attitudes towards male children and behaviour management by schools and sort of gender-driven responses. So I think it's certainly an area worthy of further exploration, but also we know for many girls and younger women, their disability sometimes is not diagnosed till later as well, or they're underdiagnosed, and that's particularly around things like autism spectrum disorder that we know there is an underdiagnosis of girls in that category. So I haven't got a scientific answer for you, Rob. More of a gut feel, but certainly worthy of further exploration.
I want to pick up on social isolation. Now, we know there's fairly extensive evidence coming forward that one of the great impacts of COVID-19, and especially in kind of stay-at-home periods, which we still have in Victoria, is that social isolation is a major issue. And then following on from that, there's a lot of evidence coming forward that mental health issues are coming to the fore. When I was having a look at this report, it seems that social isolation was certainly an issue for a number of young people with disabilities in the educational kind of setting. But it seems as though some schools got something right. They were actually able to address this issue of social isolation. What can you tell us about that? What were the schools that got it right? What were they doing that worked?
Look, and one of the brilliant things about partnering with research institutions like we did with the University of New South Wales and the University of Melbourne is they were able to do some pretty sophisticated statistical analysis around what made the biggest difference for students with disability during this time. And not surprisingly, they found that social connectedness purposeful and mindful activities by education settings to facilitate that social connectedness was such a protective factor. And so that's what I love about the research, even though it does paint a pretty bleak picture. When schools got it right, it had the biggest difference on whether students felt engaged with their learning, whether they felt part of a learning community, and whether they, felt generally connected. So the sad thing in the report was that was also a challenge. We had around 70% who said they felt more socially isolated during this period. But when social connection was facilitated, that was a really important finding. And this is where one of the joys of being able to do research really quickly is you can feed this back into policy. And we've certainly been feeding this back into the Victorian government. If there's one thing that schools could do now to support students with disability to keep them connected is keep them connected with their peers, undertake things like peer learning, peer connections, because sadly some of the things we heard was students with disability weren't included in things like Google Classrooms or on Zoom meetings, or their inclusion was an afterthought. So I think the research gives us a really strong guide about what needs to happen during a pandemic. Focus on the social connectedness first, and then everything else that comes afterwards will work. So so it does paint a two stories, if you like, the kind of the good and the bad, and that's what's really excited about because it's very hard for disability advocates like ourselves. We're often telling what should have been done or what could have been done, but this is telling us what can be done to make sure students with disability are supported during this time.
Another one of the significant issues that came out, so we've got social inclusion and then for some social isolation. But another issue that's really come through with the report is the poor level of accessible educational material. So presumably educational packages have landed in homes, and this is the work that the child has to be involved with, but it's not accessible. It's hard to understand. And I think, on the home front, sometimes it's hard for parents to even understand some of this material. What picture does the report give us about the extent to which this lack of accessible educational material was a problem on the home front? What's the picture that we get of homes with these packages landing, and where do I begin?
Yeah, and look, I think it talks to a larger problem. We had around half of students who didn't receive the curriculum modification that they needed, and it comes to the heart of all students with disability should be learning the same curriculum as their non-disabled peers, but it needs to be differentiated and there needs to be reasonable adjustments provided so that they can access it on the same basis as their peers. So we heard really varying reports. Some where the expectations were too high because the curriculum wasn't modified appropriately. There wasn't that attempt to think, okay, well, everyone in the class is looking like is learning this, how would it look like for this student if they were to successfully access that curriculum? And then on the other hand, we heard really low expectations where, you know, some students were sent home, you know, in year seven, being in year seven, grade one level work. So that is not, you know, so whilst you might say, oh, well, that's a curriculum modification, it's not the right curriculum modification to have really low expectations of students with disability during the time. You know, it is their human right and under the Disability Standards for Education to be able to access the same curriculum as other students, but modified and reasonably adjusted. So it does tell a pretty tragic tale, which already happens before COVID. So this COVID situation just reinforce the inequity that students with disability already face in their education.
Do you see that this is really uncovering deficiencies that are all already and there in the education system? That we it's just COVID's kind of made it clearer.
That's a difficult question to answer because every year we do an annual education survey, and our results are sadly very consistent year on year, that students with disability are not receiving the supports they need to access the curriculum on an equal basis. And a really interesting finding was around individual education plans. So every student with disability will often have an individual education plan, which is around how they will be able to access the curriculum on an equal basis and be supported in their education. We had very, very few schools who updated those individual education plans. So you might be able to argue, well, if they already had a well-designed individual education plan, they might need to be updated by COVID. But our results show, well, they weren't updated, they received a poor experience, so perhaps we need to question, are individual education plans that should be developed with the teacher, with the student, with the family and any other professionals that are involved in that student's life. So it kind of questions even the validity of individual education plans. So it has shone a light on the lack of individual planning that happens for students with disability.
It's quite extraordinary, really, when you think about it. I mean, there's a great diversity in the way we learn and what works for us, what's challenging, you know, where we've got potential. It seems so critical that there should be a plan in place and that it should be updated because, you know, development happens and children change. And let's hope that if we've caught sight of this problem, that it might be addressed down the track.
And certainly that'll be the evidence that we'll be providing to the Disability Royal Commission as well in terms of, you know, what needs to happen to ensure students can access their human rights to education. Because one of the risks is that everyone says, oh, learning from home is hard for everyone. It's not just students with disability. Yet you have to layer over that the existing inequality that they already face.
Absolutely. Look, the report provides a number of really interesting pictures, and I encourage anybody listening with an interest in education and disability to give attention to the report. We'll have the link on our website. But one of the interesting pictures that comes through is, as you mentioned earlier, a number of the respondents, the young person has an NDIS package. And for people who aren't familiar with NDIS, and I'm certainly not an expert, but an NDIS package means that there's government funding and there's buckets of money for specific things for the person in their life. So a number of families registered that with COVID-19, life changed. There needed to be some flexibility with the funding in order for life to proceed in these changed circumstances. So there was a great need for flexibility, but only 5% of respondents actually requested that NDIS do a plan review. So went to NDIS and said, we need to change some things. So the 5%'s the intriguing bit. I'm really interested in what that low number of people who engaged with NDIS for the review says. What story does it tell us about how families with young people with disability experience the NDIS system and having to negotiate with that system?
Look, in our free text field, we had a lot of comments from families along the lines of, I don't have capacity for that battle. Or our LAC, our local area coordinator, that is, said, oh, no, you won't be able to do that. You might have to pay money back if you use some of your NDIS support to provide more support in the home. And what it showed is there was a lag in information because obviously the NDIS has come out in the second wave in Victoria and so encouraging families to use their NDIS plan flexible during remote learning. But there was a lag in that information getting through and it didn't get through down to the local area coordinators in time when we were doing this first survey. So I think what it tells us again about pandemic planning is traditional borders and boundaries need to shift and move to make sure that there's not harm done for people with disability at this time. And it's all very well saying, you know, education is the responsibility of states and territories. NDIS provides disability support and they should never come together, if you like, if you know what I mean, because there's a hard boundary. But what we've found is there needs to be much more fluid boundaries. Yes, education still has the role of providing education, but if students who were previously at school are now at home, then how is that student being supported at home when we know, when we saw from our report that supports from education completely dropped away during this time. So we've been pleased with the recent announcements by the NDIA around that flexibility and hopefully, you know, some of the data that we've provided helped encourage that flexibility. But I think there is a real recognition that we need to make it easier for families. And so I think if we were doing that survey again now in the second lockdown, hopefully families would feel that they would be more able to get a plan review or quickly use their NDIS funds flexibly. And, you know, and there's been some good changes. So, let's wait and see. And, you know, we may even follow up with some of these families to see how they're going down the track.
Absolutely. That would be very interesting to see, you know, how the changes, how they experienced the changes and you know, whether there was improvement from their end. But it certainly says something that, you know, when you hear language of, you know, that it's a battle, you know, the kind of words that people say about how they experience the system tell us a great amount about the emotional cost, I guess, and the psychological cost of negotiating with the system.
Absolutely, and it's a big system, and the advice you might get from one LAC might differ from another LAC. So how do we embed that consistency across? And one of the really great things the NDIA did during the pandemic is they updated their frequently asked questions really regularly, and they were listening to us as we were feeding back these questions. But I think that education NDIA divide has only been negotiated and that flexibility really made clear of late. So I think for future pandemics or bushfires or whatever emergencies we have, we need to, and we've seen this with aged care, that this blurring between what's a federal responsibility versus what's a state responsibility, in the end, we're a whole person that we're talking about and people live their whole lives. They don't base it on whether one part of government does it or another part of government does it.
So the report highlights that over half of parents with a child with a disability, so in the people who responded, so over half of the parents with a child with disability in the education system find they have to pay out of their own pockets for the supports the child needs in the education system. So, and you've mentioned rights. So we're signatory to the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disability, and it's a convention that emphasises that we're obliged as a country to ensure that children with disabilities receive the support they need within the general education system to facilitate their effective education. I want to quote it because it's so important for us to hear that there's a right to support, to get the education that the child is entitled to. So something's not working nationally and locally if parents have to cover support costs out of their own pockets. Something is drastically wrong there. So what needs to happen in our education system to ensure that we actually do fully comply with the convention that we've signed up to?
Look, part of it comes down to, yes, human rights, but part of it comes around the National Consistent Collection of Data, which is collects data on the reasonable adjustments that are needed for students with disability in Australia, and that's completed nationally. And that tells us around 20% of students with disability require some form of reasonable adjustment so that they can access the curriculum on the same basis as their non-disabled peers. And then that drives the funding model that goes to the states and territories. However, if there's a particular student in a school that has a particular need, it doesn't translate that funding that's provided for that student actually reaches that student. And so in Victoria, for example, and I only say Victoria because I'm a local to Victoria and in the middle of lockdown, it's very much based on diagnostic criteria. So you've got to go through, you know, you've got to be below a certain level of IQ or you've got to have a certain condition before you'll get funded, rather than looking at the functional needs of the child and how the child needs. So we haven't got needs-based funding around students with disabilities. So that's a major reform that needs to happen in terms of, and Tasmania has just introduced needs-based funding. And given that 20% of students with disability require some form of reasonable adjustment, but say, for example, in Victoria, only around about 4% of students with disability get funding or get support or their school gets support, that would tell you that the money's not being as targeted as well as it can to make sure. So there's those results about you know, families needing to chip in does not surprise me at all. It's not that there's not enough money in the system. And I think that's a common furphy. Oh, well, we can't include students with disability because, you know, our school doesn't have enough resources. It's an absolute furphy because there is funding in the system, but is it being used in the right way? And certainly that's the sort of things that we're talking to the Disability Royal Commission, because what we find and what we want is every student, regardless of their disability, is included in their local school and not sent off to special schools because it's seen that they'll get more support. And the UN Convention, as you rightly mentioned, clarifies that no form of inclusive education is provided in segregated education settings. The research evidence also tells us that it benefits all students, those who are disabled and non-disabled, when students are included in regular education settings. So if we want to have the sort of inclusive society that we want to have and we all aspire to, it's got to start at education. If you've never gone through school and met a person with disability, how are you going to go on and employ a person with disability? So we need to stop othering students with disability and making sure that they're included in every local primary school, every high school, but with the right supports.
It sounds like kind of the critical bit from what you've said is that the definition of disability is very limited. So you only see what you're looking for. So it sounds like in this system there's this very limited medical model, maybe version of seeing disability. So you're not seeing the whole person and therefore you're not seeing the whole need and not being able to deliver. Is that the case? Is that the key bit there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And when we see these rigid diagnostic criteria for funding, it ignores the fact that the functional needs of one student who doesn't fall within that diagnostic criteria, which again is a medical model, who might have more needs, they completely miss out on funding. So that's why we say we need to move to a functional needs-based way of funding. The Commonwealth has the funding levers. They do provide funding based on the NCCD. It's the way the states and territories implement the funding that needs to be examined and looked at.
It sounds like Tassie, I'm from Tasmania originally, so I can be a little bit proud. It sounds like Tassie's actually got its act together with this, so it's probably worthwhile for other states and territories to have a look at what Tasmania's done in that area.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the other thing Tasmania has done is said is, if you're saying this reasonable adjustment is needed, you actually must provide it. Because, you know, we know 20% of students with disability, 20% of the student population have some form of reasonable adjustment, but can we be sure that it is actually those reasonable adjustments are being provided? And so that accountability and monitoring to make sure those reasonable adjustments are provided is key to the future.
We are living through, it's not finished yet, and certainly not in Victoria, this very traumatic time with COVID-19 for all of us, but particularly for young people with disability. It's been a very disrupted time. It's been a lot of uncertainty. And I think we're all doing a lot of processing in our heads that we're probably not even fully aware of ourselves. And you would think that in terms of achieving goals that we need to take that into account. What does the report tell us about schools making adjustments when it comes to their expectations related to students, their learning and their performance? Have schools kind of adjusted their expectations to these strange times we're living in?
Look, again, we heard many different. For some schools, and for some families, they realised just how far behind their student was and how the school had been not, you know, there was a real gap between where they felt the student's ability would be versus where, you know, with the type of work the schools were providing. So low expectations was something that really came through. And then, you know, we heard of, in the very early days, curriculum being sent home, like, you know, make your bed, wash the dishes, you know, all that sort of life skills stuff, which is not reasonably adjusting the Australian curriculum. And so we need to make sure, and that's something we hear constantly around high expectations. How are we having high expectations for students with disability, not, you know, low expectations, which is so insidious and has plagued the disability community for millennia. Yeah, so we need to move. And so I think this report highlights that in some cases, students with disability did better at home because there was less anxiety, there was, you know, more focused attention that was being provided in the home, and then other students who were really left behind.
COVID-19's shone a light on work that still needs to be done. So as we've said, it's kind of uncovered a lot that's always there in terms of us not getting things right for people with disability. What's the way forward for us nationally in progressing the work of building greater inclusion in our schools and in our education system? What do we need to do to get things right?
Yeah,
it's a big question.
It is. And look, we've thought about this long and hard, particularly around education. And we're part of an Australian Coalition for Inclusive Education, which CIDA co-convenes and chairs, which brings together disability advocacy organisations around the country. And we've developed a 10-year roadmap for change around how education needs to transform to ensure equality, starting with, you know, the legislative environment. We don't have a human rights-based Inclusive Education Act in this country. We have anti-discrimination law, but having discrimination law is insufficient in itself. We need a rights-based legislation which really puts those rights front and central. We also need to, you know, phase out segregated education, not overnight, but there needs to be a plan to demobilise segregated education. We need to look at things like gatekeeping, where schools will, where students will try and enrol, or families will try and enrol their student, yet the school says, oh, we don't have the resources, or you'd be better off going to that special school up the road where they can actually support you better. We need to be making sure that we're building the capability of teachers to be able to adjust the Australian curriculum for students. What are the skills? If you're learning about the gold rush, for example, how can you differentiate that from a really high-achieving student, if you like, right to a student with disability who may be non-verbal? What are the sort of skills that you need to actually differentiate that curriculum so everyone's learning about the gold rush, for example, but it's differentiated across the whole spectrum, not just for students with disability, so that everyone can access the curriculum on an equal basis. So there are a few ideas. There's lots more, but obviously they're the sort of things we're presenting to the Disability Royal Commission. And then I guess the other thing is we have a national disability strategy that's, we had our first 10 years of the national disability strategy. Consultations are open and we'll be certainly putting in some very firm recommendations about the national disability strategy needing to be a really important pillar of enabling people with disability to have their rights enacted.
Tremendous. Mary, this is a really important report, so not even remotely fair. And it follows from More Than Isolated. So there's two reports from CYDA, two important reports that give us a whole lot of information and feedback from people, families with children with disabilities in terms of their experiences of COVID. Important work. Thank you, and thanks to the team involved in putting these reports together. And we look forward to, you know, seeing further reports and good work from your organisation. It's key and it's very important. Mary, thank you very much for joining us on our podcast today.
Thanks very much, Rob. Really appreciate it.